Well, for about 9 years now, I have known of Dr. Stephen Greer, and I've known him now for several years since I've been doing Coast to Coast AM. A man dedicated, a man who has pushed himself very, very far, sometimes to the brink, to try to get this disclosure project in the minds of all of us in this country and worldwide. And this time, for the very first time, I've read something that is just so compelling and so emotional in his, basically his memoirs, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, where he just lays it all out about his own personal experience trying to do what he has done in this field for so many years. In a moment, our special guest, Dr. Stephen Greer on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Stephen Greer, founder, CEO of Space Energy Access Systems, also the founder and director of the Disclosure Project. He's an emergency physician, former chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine at Caldwell Memorial Hospital. Dr. Greer is a lifetime member of Alpha, Omega Alpha, the nation's most prestigious medical honor society. He has appeared on several national programs, including, obviously, Coast to Coast, but Larry King Show, CBS, the BBC, NTV in Japan. Dr. Greer has been supervising a worldwide search for alternative energy sources, specifically those known as zero-point or over-unity devices, with a plan to identify and develop systems which will hopefully eliminate the need for fossil fuels. And, of course, you know about the Disclosure Project. We're going to talk with Dr. Greer tonight. Stephen, I got to tell you, you poured your guts out in Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. You put your whole life in there.
Well, I put a lot of it in there. It actually is an oral history. A couple years ago, we had about 25 people out here at our farm in near Thomas Jefferson's home in Virginia here. And I pretty much spoke for a week about what I had experienced since my youth, what I'd experienced doing the Disclosure Project and briefing people like the CIA director and the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency and all these officials in Washington, and really put it into sort of human terms of what it's been like for me personally to do this and sort of be on the, hot seat dealing with this very difficult issue for now 16 years.
Well, you know, I have listened to you for years with Art and then with me over the last couple of years. And in the book, I've learned so much more about you that I didn't know in talking to you. And I didn't know when I heard your interviews with Art before. I mean, this one got personal. And there were moments where I was sharing your incredible emotions that were obviously there. And there were other moments I was happy with you and frustrated with you and everything else as you went along to try to get the world to understand what you've been trying to do all these years.
Right. I mean, in a sense, this book, which is called Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, is my own personal disclosure. And a lot of people have asked me over the years, good God, why did you do this? What compelled you to leave your medical work to get this information out to the world? And why? What happened to you? And this is a book that really describes the personal dimension of it from the time when I was very young, 8 or 9 years old, and actually saw one of these UFOs at fairly close range, and subsequently had a number of contact experiences with the actual ETs. And this continued on up through my college years, where I had a number of amazing close encounters. And I sort of describe what the nexus of these encounters involved, and it really involves that place within ourselves where the conscious mind becomes a universal resonator and I think is the universal communicator across all dimensions and all of space and time. And I try to explain this to people to get a glimpse, give a glimpse to the reader of what it's been like for me to experience these things and also what's really been the motivating force behind my involvement in these issues.
When you were doing this and you were in a position to leave your chairmanship of the ER room at the hospital and devote your time to disclosure, I mean, were people looking at you like, Stephen, have you lost it? What are you doing?
Yeah, well, I think that the people who haven't understood what's really behind the effort have asked that. And you know, there are several things behind this effort. One is some experiences I had in my youth, which we can talk about later if you'd like.
Sure.
Showed me a future of not just world peace, but of universal peace and what the future of the human race really entails. And that's really, in a sense, what this book is about. It's a vision of not only where we are and sort of what time we're emerging out of, but what is the time on that near horizon that's approaching very quickly, where humanity is not only going to be a global civilization, but will be an interplanetary one. And eventually, I'm convinced we're going to be extraterrestrials to other civilizations that are emerging out in space. And when I found out, of course, not only about that issue, but also from sources that we developed through the 1990s and up and well as recently as last week, of sources within the intelligence and technology communities, that, you know, the world that we're living in is a faint shadow of the world we can have and should have, and that, you know, all sorts of intervening agendas that have to do with secrecy and greed and, if I might say so, stupidity, have withheld from the human race that good future, which is really our birthright and which we are long overdue to attain. And frankly, this involves being able to live in a sustainable fashion on this planet using technologies that we know exist and can prove exist and have been withheld from humanity, mainly because of a massive power grab around the world that's been spinning out of control for at least 50 years and perhaps 75 years.
You know, you're in an industry now or a field where you have so many people who are complimentary about what you have done in the efforts that you have undertaken. Then you've got a handful, a very small handful, that is, I don't know whether you could say they're jealous of what you've done, Stephen, or bitter of what you've done, but they've taken their shots because they're not happy with the direction some of the things have gone in. And we'll talk about some of that, too, because it's just
right.
Because you mention a lot of that in your book.
You can't step into this field without stepping into enormous controversy. And one of the things I point out to people is that if you take the Canadian memo from 1951, the so-called Wilbur Smith memo, the top-secret declassified memo, and in it... In this top-secret memo, it says that this subject is the most classified subject within the United States and that the secrecy surrounding it surpasses the development of a hydrogen bomb, which, of course, we were working on in 1951. And if you look at that, you can understand that a field like this that's been relatively unfunded and not very professionalized is very easily infiltrated by people who I think are to use an old phrase, agents provocateurs. They're people who are out there to stir up trouble and to confuse people and to really create a whole lot of smoke and mirrors so that people don't know what the hell is going on, quite frankly. And one of my tasks has been to try to sift through that and see to the best of my ability, with my own limitations as a human being, what really is going on and sharing that with the public in a way that can be constructive and positive. And so that's really been what's been motivating this whole effort. And, you know, I had a conversation a couple weeks ago when I was in Canada with former Minister of Defense Paul Hellyer.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I had a virtually an entire day together to discuss this issue. And one of the things that you know, he shared with me was that he knew that the world was being run by, quote, a permanent shadow government that had nothing to do with elections and nothing to do with democracy and nothing to do with the promise of America or the promise of the human race. And he knew this to be a fact. And we discussed this and how it related to UFO secrecy and the technologies behind it and also the whole issue of how the human relationship, which is very embryonic and early, with extraterrestrial civilizations has been hijacked by shills for this covert shadow government who would like to scare the heck out of people and would like to see that we spin off in the direction of conflict rather than in the direction of universal peace, which I think is the destiny of the human race.
I want to get your reaction later to a Hellyer, but you know what? There, a few years ago, I would have said to you or anybody else who talked about a shadow government or people who are controlling elected officials, I would have said, you guys are nuts.
Right.
Not anymore, Stephen. Not anymore. I am now more convinced than ever that what you say about that is absolutely true. And part of the program now has steered it into a direction so that one day in the future, all of us can be able to fight back at this because you can see it unfold now. I mean, they are now obvious where in the old days everything was hidden,
right.
Now it's like right out there.
It is. It's hidden in plain sight, as we like to say. And in the preface of this book that we actually it's barely being distributed now. It's online at the disclosureproject.org and a couple other places, and people can get it by calling 888-ETCSETI. CSCSETI is the organization. But in the preface, I say, look, I had a meeting at the Pentagon with one of the highest-ranking generals there. He was head of a major intelligence unit. And he told me this story about how his father had known about some extraordinary secrets in this sort of shadow government cabal that was running things. And this general turned to me and to my military advisor and said, you know, Dr. Greer, I thought the old man was a kook. He's talking about his father now, who is a government official. And he says, finally, my father killed himself because no one would listen. And he was so despondent over the weight of this. And he turned to me, and this was the first meeting I had had with this general. He turned to me and he said, you know, I didn't think anything that man was saying could have been true until I got into this position. And the position he had, by the way, was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, one of the most powerful entities at the Pentagon. And when he looked at me in the eyes and said that, I just felt this chill run down my spine, and I thought, well, I can understand that. You know, even my own children, how much of this can they even believe is happening? Because, you know, here is this man who was saying that even his own father, it was just too much for him to take until he got to be in his 50s, and he was sitting there in this very powerful position at the Pentagon, and he saw firsthand how he was being stiff-armed aside when he tried to look into this issue and how he was being lied to. So, you know, it's a very steep learning curve, and for many people, it really sounds like, you know, sort of a conspiracy theory or something that's just kind of too far out to be true until you start really looking at the facts and the evidence, and you see that it is true. And one of the things I've tried to do with the Disclosure Project, disclosureproject.org, is to put out there the testimony of people over 40, 50 years of military and intelligence history, top secret witnesses who have seen events and seen projects and have seen the cover-up firsthand, talk about how that is effective, up to and including assassinations and intimidation and deceiving high officials. You know, one of the big shocks for me in the 90s that I share in this book was being asked to go up and do a briefing for the sitting CIA director, who I had been told was being denied access to these projects. And
that was William Colby at the time, right?
No, this was actually Woolsey, R. James Woolsey,
okay.
Who was President Clinton's first CIA director. And he was the sitting CIA director at the time, and here I am in an emergency position in North Carolina, and I'm going, what the hell am I doing briefing a CIA director? And he, you know, when we met, he made it very clear that he and the president were being denied access to these projects, even though they were going on. And, of course, subsequent to that, I ended up meeting with Senator Claiborne Pell, Senator Richard Bryan, who had been on the Intelligence Committee for the Senate, and many other high officials in the Congress and in other governments who had told me the same thing. In fact, Minister of Defense Paul Hellyer just told me that he knew nothing of this, and he was quite sure that Prime Minister Trudeau and Prime Ministers Pierce and Trudeau that he had worked under also did not know about this subject, even though there are Canadian projects dealing with this issue.
Let's go back then to the beginning, if we can, your boyhood experiences and lead into some of the things that you found, of course, to be just revelations that have affected you. But you said at this young age of about eight or so, things started happening for you. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, this was around the time that my uncle, my mom's oldest brother, was designing the lunar module that took the first man to the moon. As you know, he was the senior project engineer at Grumman that had the contract to build the lunar module. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was very interested in space and the idea that humans were going to be going into space because I had my closest uncle building the thing that was going to land there on the moon. So around that time, I had a sighting of broad daylight of a silvery disk, seamless. It appeared and then disappeared. It didn't just fly in. And there were some other boys with me at the time. And, of course, my parents, who were very reductionist and very rational, said, oh, well, you know, this is a young boy's imagination. But, you know, children know what they see.
Sure.
And I was a sharp little guy, and I said, oh, my God, I just saw a UFO. So I became very interested in this, and I began to have some experiences at night in the lucid dream state with these extraterrestrial beings that were on that craft. And I've never talked about this before, frankly.
Hold that. In all the interviews, I've never heard you talk about this specifically.
Yeah, no, and you know, it sort of harkens back to this Lockheed Skunk Works guy that we've been working with for some years who relayed to me a similar experience he had when he was working under Kelly Johnson at Lockheed, where he had this experience in the state of consciousness that some would call a lucid dream with these non-human life forms. And people say, well, they weren't, how do you know they were extraterrestrial and biological? It's because there's a physical component to the experience as well as a conscious component. And I didn't really understand it as an 8 or 9 year old boy, but about 8, 9 years later, when I was 17, I became very, very sick because of an injury to my left leg. And I relate this in this book, The Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. And I had a near-death experience. And instead of going to the pearly gate someplace, my great love was space. And so I went out into space, and I had an extraordinary experience. First, of what some would call cosmic consciousness, where the mind that I experienced as my own was one with the mind of the universe, the awake being that's there. And it was beautiful, and there was nothing frightening about it. It was just a stunningly beautiful experience. And subsequently, I had an experience with these two very enlightened beings. Some would call them avatars or kind of manifestations of divinity, that approached me and said, you know, a number of things. But one of the things they said is that you could either come with them or I could return back to the earth. And I thought to myself, well, I had enough presence of mind, even though I wasn't raised in a religious family, to say, well, what's your will? What should I do?
Yeah.
And I was told that I should come back to the earth. And with that, I did. But not before I went into a state of awareness where the only way I can explaining it is sort of a unity state of consciousness or God consciousness, and it was beautiful. And at that point, I never was afraid of death again. You know, I was raised, I always joke that my parents were very devout atheists. They didn't believe in anything. You couldn't put in a test tube, didn't exist. But this experience was so transformative at age 17 that I began to really search what it meant to be awake, what it meant to be a human. And subsequently, I learned some meditation techniques, very ancient ones from the Vedas, the ancient Vedic Sanskrit literature, and began to practice a technique where I could go into that state of cosmic consciousness frequently. In fact, I'll never forget the time that my teacher was instructing me in this technique, and I sat down and I, bam, went right back into that state of unbounded, pure consciousness that you hear about, the sort of samadhi state. And he looked at me at the end of the meditation and says, "You went there, didn't you?" And I said, "Yeah, weren't you supposed to?" And, of course, he kind of laughed. He said, "Yes, but people generally don't." And then I explained to him that I'd had this near-death experience where the veils of the material cosmos were stripped away, and I was left with this oneness with the awake mind of the cosmos. And he says, "Well, no wonder you can arrive there easily." So this led to a number of extraordinary things over the next few months. The chief one being that I was up in the mountains of North Carolina when I was out of college at age 18 now, 6 months later, and I decided to go up to the top of this mountain and meditate at sunset. And as I went up to the very top of this over 5,000-foot mountain, I looked in the west, southwest, and here was this exact same spaceship that I saw when I was 8 years old.
Oh, my.
And it appeared, materialized, connected with me, and then dematerialized. And the only thing that I thought was, oh, my God, well, they're back. I mean, that's all I really thought. And I sat and meditated, and it got dark. And at the end of the meditation, I went into this enormous, unbounded state of consciousness again. And after that, an amazing contact happened.
Well, Stephen, we'll talk about that. And I got to tell you, I've never heard you this open before. Fascinating. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with our guest, Dr. Stephen Greer. I'm going to read you a little part of the foreword in Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. It says, "This courageous work is not for the meek. Many cutting-edge scientists have been threatened, murdered, and otherwise suppressed by cascades of disinformation and personal attacks. Dr. Greer has endured all this to our benefit." That was written by Apollo astronaut Dr. Brian O'Leary as a foreword to this book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. So, Stephen, you climb a 5,000-foot mountain. You're at the top in North Carolina, and you see the same craft that you saw when you were a youngster. What happened?
That's right, and I think what's more important about that experience was that in the meditation I had on top of the mountain, I went into the same state of spirit or consciousness that I had when I had the near-death experience almost exactly 6 months earlier. And at the end of it, I stood up, and it was crystal clear air at that altitude in October of 1973. And as I looked up at the sky and saw the Milky Way galaxy, a thought not my own came to me and said, "Behold, what a beautiful universe God has made." And with that, I went into a state of cosmic awareness, even as I was awake and standing on the mountain. And I became aware of this glow off the top of the mountain, just out of the range of vision. But it was obviously right beneath the crest of the mountain. And then I sensed there was someone standing beside me. And I looked over, and here was a 3 to 4 foot high, maybe a little taller, extraterrestrial life form. But, of course, I'm an 18-year-old guy. I just turned 18 in June of that year. And I didn't know what this thing was. And I kind of got on the ground. I remember getting almost like in the fetal position, thinking, what does this animal want with me? And this is an extraordinary experience. And I then stood up again, and it came over and touched me on my right shoulder so firmly. I had a ski jacket on that I saw the jacket indent. And as it touched my right shoulder, all the hair on my body just went on end, like sort of a electricity sort of effect.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that in, like, magic houses and things. You touch a ball.
It was amazing. And it was a very attractive-looking extraterrestrial being. It had very human-looking eyes, but more almond-shaped. And with that, I went into this state of consciousness, and we floated, literally floated, like a levitation experience, right on board this craft. And next thing I know, we were out in space, but in a state where, if you imagine being in a vessel where the whole thing is fiber optics, where you just see the space around you. But I was there physically, but it was as if you were there without the need of any physical container. And as I was sitting with this being and several other extraterrestrial beings that were from different planetary systems, I learned that what they were interested in me for wasn't about me personally, but so much as the fact of what is it like for a young man in that time in history to be experiencing universal consciousness. And we literally sat in meditation together. That was the purpose. And it was on that night that we sort of co-created the CSETI, the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, what's called the CE5 contact protocols, where we take people out into the field where these UFOs have been seen, go into this state of consciousness, remote view the ET craft, zoom into Earth from space, showing the ETs where we're located, and vector them into a close encounter. And that experience was first sort of co-created during this incredible encounter on this mountain back in 1973. And as I relate this in the book, I remember when I was telling this story to the group of people gathered out here at the farm, people said, "Well, you know, what did you talk about?" I said, "This isn't talking about linear things. This is about experiencing that state of consciousness, which is the universal resonator, the universal connector amongst all peoples in the cosmos. And that's that quiet state of awareness within us that is eternal, that is infinite, that is unbounded." And I know that the reason they were interested in this experience with me was that they knew that I had experienced it a few months earlier in this near-death amazing experience that transformed my life, and figured that I would maybe understand how to take it to the next step in terms of a communication technique with these extraterrestrial life forms. And after a period of that, I found myself back on the top of this mountain, but about, I'd say, a quarter of a mile down this gravel road that was locked at the bottom of the mountain.
Yeah.
And suddenly I realized that I had this unusual field around me where I could go 20 or 30 feet in one step. So in other words, I was sort of had an anti-gravity energy field that was still around me. So I remember in this state of enormous joy, you know, bounding down this mountain, which is called Riches Mountain outside of the little town of Boone, North Carolina. And I was bounding down this mountain. And as I got down to the little town, this little college town, it was deserted. And I thought, my God, this was during the Yom Kippur War. I said, maybe we went to DEFCON whatever and had a nuclear exchange.
And everybody's gone, huh?
And everyone's gone. And I realized that actually what I thought had been, half an hour or so was actually 2 or 3 hours in this transcendent state of consciousness with a whole group of these extraterrestrial people on board this vehicle. And when I got to town, I realized it was actually 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. And back then, they used to have curfews for dorms. I was locked out of my dorm. It was this whole mess trying to get back in. But this was really how the entire CSETI and Disclosure Project focus effort came into being. And it was I was 18 years old in 1973 with this contact experience that happened up on the mountain. And after that, for many nights, I would practice this protocol of going into this state of unbounded mind, remote viewing deep space, connecting to these extraterrestrial people and their vehicles, and then vectoring them into that part of North Carolina where I was living. And each night I did that, there were all these reports that were actually in the papers of rangers seeing these UFOs over Shining Rock Wilderness and over Linville Gorge Wilderness and over all these areas. And after a close encounter happened with a young man who looked a great deal like me driving between Morganton and Boone, North Carolina, I said, I better stop this. This seems to be working. And so I stopped doing this experiment at that time because I didn't know what to do with it. And, of course, it was eventually formalized into the CSETI CE5 protocols in 1990. But that's really how I got started on this whole path. And all through my years, after that, I ended up becoming very interested in higher states of consciousness, became a meditation teacher, eventually moved to Israel where I met my wife, which is another incredible story. I actually met my wife in a lucid dream. I had 5 nights in a row. I'd never met her physically until I had these dreams.
Now, was she having the same kind of dream?
No.
She was not.
But as soon as we met, it's like we'd always known each other.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of connection. And but all those years and then going into medical school and being a physician, I sort of left this issue behind, in a sense. A few times I experimented with this protocol and had an amazing encounter. For example, in 1975, I was up in the Maritime Alps of France, and in this book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, I relate going out after I had done this protocol one morning. I was sitting in this meditative state and connected to these extraterrestrial life forms in their vehicle, and said, very almost childishly, I thinking back on it, I said, well, yeah, you probably don't remember who I am, but my name is Steve, and we met in this mountain in North Carolina in 1973, this whole thing. But then I went into this steady state of coherent stream of consciousness and showed them where we were in the Maritime Alps of France. And as I was walking around outside the hotel where we were staying, up in Isola, France, actually is where it was located. I was with a group of my friends, and suddenly in a crystal clear sky, I guess there were about half a dozen of us up above the hotel, here comes this tetrahedral-shaped, crystal clear extraterrestrial vehicle that appeared out of this blue sky and descended towards us. I had a friend with me who kind of became unhinged, and she said, she knew I'd had this experience a couple years before. I'd confided that to her, and no one else knew about it, really. She says, were you contacting these ETs and invited them to come here? And I said, yeah, that's kind of sheepish. She said, oh, my God, don't ever do that. I'm terrified. She was really kind of freaked out. I said, well, there's nothing to be afraid of. I said, they're completely harmless, and they're very enlightened beings, and here they come. And so they continue to descend and continue to descend and continue to descend, at this enormous tetrahedral-shaped craft with the sun shining off of it. And at the point where I sensed that she and a couple other people I was with became very afraid, it stopped. And then it receded, and then it just dematerialized, vanished in front of everyone's eyes. And this was the first mass witness CE5, Close Encounter of the Fifth Kind.
Was it your belief, Stephen, at this point that these were extraterrestrials from planetary systems, or were you thinking dimensional, maybe even from a multiverse?
No, I knew they were extraterrestrial, but I knew that they were using interdimensional technologies to traverse the universe.
Ah, okay.
And see, this is what everyone gets confused. I remember having this debate with Jacques Vallée when I was doing a briefing for the Board of Noetic Sciences with astronaut Edgar Mitchell a few years ago, and he would say, oh, well, they're interdimensional. And I went up to the stage and I picked up the microphone and I said, this is interdimensional. Everything is conscious mind resonating at a frequency as that object. And I said, if you understand that, you understand something very profound about the nature of reality. And so when you're dealing with these extraterrestrial civilizations that are going through interstellar distances, they, by definition, have to, some would say, dematerialize or shift into a non-linear, non-material aspect of reality, where they then can appear in one point of space-time and then traverse enormous distances and go to another point in space-time very, very quickly. And all of their technologies involve an interface between the material cosmos and what some would call the sort of etheric or astral level and the conscious mind that's within all things. Literally everything in the entire creation is awake. And there are very good studies that have been done at Princeton by Dr. Bob John and others that I've worked with, where, you know, they have shown that even engineering and mechanical systems can be affected by the consciousness and thought of a person in the room with it, or even a person at a distance. And so when you look at what that means, what it means is that these extraterrestrial civilizations are able to utilize the understanding of the, what some would call interdimensional aspects of the universe. I choose to call it the spectrum of reality that involves everything from the material cosmos to the etheric, to the world of thought and ideas, to the pure conscious mind that's shining within everything. And these technologies that extraterrestrials have involve a very wide spectrum, wider than what we've been taught in our sciences at MIT and Caltech is possible. Now, I will say, in covert human programs, they've been experimenting with these things for
a long time.
A long time. And I know people who've been in those projects, and I know them very well. But when you're dealing with extraterrestrial civilizations, it's correct to say that they're extraterrestrial and biological. It's also correct to say, if you will, that they're transdimensional, interdimensional.
Did you know about, at this time, that eventually, one day, when you became Dr. Stephen Greer, the man, that you were going to be putting together this project Disclosure, this Disclosure project?
Yes. When I had the near-death experience, something I share with people now that I never like to talk about, if I'm discussing these things, I must be honest about it. I went into a state of consciousness where this divine being that was there communicated in non-verbal, non-linear packets of knowledge that at that time, as a 17-year-old, was very abstract. It's very hard for me to even describe it. But if you can imagine, you know, if you say the word apple, there's a sound to it, apple. And in your mind, you can see a red apple.
Mm-hmm.
But within that thought is the essence, what's called the causal idea form of that apple, that is pre-verbal. That's actually the resonant tone of the thought of that thing. Now, in the Sanskrit, this is called Ritambara Pragya, and I used to teach people about this state of consciousness called Ritambara Pragya. But essentially, this experience was an extraordinary thing where there was this sort of information being, if you will, downloaded or conveyed, but not in words. And it unfolded over, and quite frankly, I think all of us have this folded within us at some level that's very ancient, and our whole life here and in the hereafter is about having that knowledge unfolding within us.
I agree with that. So at what age, Stephen, did you start putting together the project? How old?
Well, the project really began in the roots of it. I'm sharing it sort of my as we joke, my misspent youth really started at in those early years when I was 8 and then 18 and then 20 and 22 with these extraordinary experiences. But it wasn't until 1990, and I was working as a physician and running this emergency department, and we were a very busy place, 25,000-30,000 trauma emergency cases a year. And, I had four daughters by that point. And I was in the upstairs of this enormous house we had. We had this ridiculously huge house right next to the Biltmore Castle in Asheville, North Carolina. And it was this 8,000-square-foot house.
Oh, my.
And I'm wandering around in this house, getting changed up in my bedroom, and it's in the afternoon. And suddenly, very clearly, a command was sent to me, and it said, pick up that which you have dropped. And it was not a pejorative. It wasn't a sort of an accusatory way. But with that, I knew exactly what it meant. And I said, well, it's time. And as soon as that thought entered, I knew it was time to form CSETI and the Disclosure Project and move this along. And that was in January of 1990. Of course, going from there to trying to figure out what the heck I'm supposed to do with this was very difficult. That experience happened on the full moon of January of 1990. In the full moon of February of 1990, I went to a meeting in Asheville with some friends that was sort of a spiritual meeting and meditation meeting. And there was a woman there who I'd never heard of, I forget her name now, who in front of all these people stopped the meeting, turned to me and said, you have a profound connection with extraterrestrials, and you need to pick up what you dropped. She used the same words.
Same words,
and,
yeah.
Of course, I wanted to crawl underneath the chair. So here I am, you know, a doctor in this town, and for God's sake.
Everybody knew you.
Yes, and it was very embarrassing, to be quite frank with you. And I didn't know what to do. And then on the full moon of March of 1990, and I go into this in great detail in the book, I was in, went to bed, and I awakened with this enormous craft out in the front lawn of this huge estate that we lived on, and that we owned, and I found myself having another one of these extraordinary and rather beautiful contact experiences, where it became very clear to me what I needed to do, and so it sort of made full circle from, you know, the experience up on the mountain when I was 18, and here in, you know, 1990, I guess I'm 35 or so. And, it was something that moved me along, but I did it sort of in kicking and screaming. I hate to use that word because, I mean, I really didn't know what to do with this issue. And but it unfolded over the next 6 months what I needed to do, and I formed the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And, you know, the first project of this, before the Disclosure Project, was the CSETI effort to create an interplanetary ambassador corps. And we do this. I mean, in fact, if anyone who wants to come can join us in Colorado in July, over the week of the 4th of July. We're taking a group of people out in the desert of Colorado to go through these protocols together. And you know, people can find out about that at csetti.org, csetti.org. But we do this and as a way of training people to prepare for contact. And what I view it as is a sort of pioneering ambassador program where we train people to experience the universal aspect of consciousness in preparation for becoming interplanetary ambassadors and openly and willingly making contact with these ET civilizations rather than just passively waiting for things to happen. My view of it is that they've been watching us a long time. They're waiting for us to wake up. They're waiting for us to reach back out. And some of the things that have happened that people don't understand, I think of the ETs trying to push us along, but they don't want to do it too frontally. Ultimately, we're the children of Earth. We have to take responsibility for this planet. We have to take responsibility for our relationship with other planets, and not by abdication of our responsibility, let some kleptocracy of petro-Nazis take that issue over and run our relationship into the ground. So in 1990, when I started CSETI, the impetus for it, which then grew into the Disclosure Project, was an interplanetary ambassador.
Interesting.
Program.
Stephen, when we come back, let's find out how you accumulated these hundreds of witnesses, pilots, military people, people who are in the know. How did you put them together? We'll be back. Stephen, are you? You've got to be aware of this Project Serpo that's out there. They've got a website. They talk about how they sent a half a dozen astronauts to another planet in an exchange program. What's your take on all that?
I haven't been able to find anyone who can confirm any aspect of that. So all I can say is that you probably know what I do. You know, there's so many stories out there about this sort of thing, that there's been some sort of exchange. And yet when I've dealt with people who've been involved in very highly placed aspects of these covert projects all the way back to the 50s and 60s, I don't see any evidence of it. So, you know, whether or not it's happened, I mean, you can't prove a negative, but I haven't seen any anything that corroborates it, and certainly don't have any firsthand sources that can corroborate it. I can corroborate something that people have wondered about,
sure,
which is explosive. And I'm going to drop this little bombshell.
Here we go.
Yeah, well, there's a few here, I guess. You know, I got an email during this last break. Someone said, oh, my God, you're kind of going into some pretty way-out stuff. What's going on with this SETI project? A lot of people confuse the parent organization of Disclosure Project, CSETI, with SETI. And SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence that Carl Sagan and these folks set up. And we recently have had confirmed to us from an extremely high-ranking SETI official that they have received multiple extraterrestrial signals, so many, in fact, that they began to get jammed by some sort of human intelligence operation that was jamming their equipment to prevent further signals from coming in. I'm hoping that this senior official with SETI will step forward with this. I know who he is. I've actually spoken with him.
And it's not Seth, is it?
I don't want to go through a process of elimination,
right,
but it's extremely high ranking. And in fact, the question then becomes, why is there this cover up going on? You know, we had an astronomer who had been involved in that SETI project years ago, who was the editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, who stated to members of Congress, and we set up the briefings in 1997 with some of the early Disclosure Project witnesses, that in fact he had been at one of the observatories when a signal came in, and that it was of extraterrestrial origin and that it was all hushed up. So, you know, the question is, why is that being suppressed? The answer is that program, unfortunately, has never been free and independent as a truly scientific search. And this is one of our concerns about these sorts of programs. I think it's more of a smokescreen, but they have actually gotten some very, very significant signals. But
and this is recent, other than the one you just mentioned?
Oh, yes. This is recent.
Okay.
And also it has been ongoing up to the point where apparently some, I don't know if it was the NRO or the NSA, began to jam the signals and distort them because they were getting too many of them, and they did not want it to continue.
Someone
did not want the SETI project to continue receiving those signals.
Okay. Well, you know, we have, and you're not telling me this, but we've had Seth on the program before. It might be worthwhile to get him back on here.
Very definitely. If he doesn't know, he ought to know this.
That's dramatic. Okay. As you began to accumulate these incredible witnesses for the project, how did you do that? I mean, who did you go to first? And how did you begin to accumulate these people?
Well, they came to me, and I think that if you go back to 1992, 1993, we were the CSETI project, and I talk about this in this new book, some of the experiences we had in, for example, near Pensacola, in Mexico, in Belgium, where the big wave of sightings was going on in the late 80s and 90s. We took teams of people there to make contact and to signal with these objects and vector them in, and we had one major sighting after another. For example, when we were down in Florida, there were at least five different videotapes and cameras going when four of these UFOs appeared in the sky and were signaling back and forth with us for about 20 minutes. Well, this got picked up by the military and the intelligence community, as you can imagine, because as one of the NSA people told me, who later met with me in the spring of 1992, he says, you guys discovered the Rosetta Stone of extraterrestrial communication. I said, yes, of course. And it has to do with consciousness and phased consciousness and coherent thought and all this sort of thing. And he said, you know, how far do you intend to take this? I said, as far as we can. And I relate that, you know, a former head of Army intelligence eventually took me to a hotel room with a whole bunch of these spooks in April of 92. And it was a bit of the rubber hose treatment, but in sort of a friendly way. But eventually they came around to saying, well, you know, just who the hell do you think you are doing this? And I said, well, I've had contact with these life forms before, and you can't fool me about who they are and why they're here. I know why they're here, and we know who they are. And I said, I'm not rich, but I don't need your money. I'm wealthy enough as a physician. You're not going to buy me off or bribe me off. And then I said, you know, when I was 17, I died. And I realized that through that experience, that near-death experience, there is no death, and that the inner state of consciousness within us is eternal. And I said, so you can threaten me, you can whack me if you want to, but I'm not going to stop doing what I'm doing. And, of course, their mouths just sort of dropped open, and the general folded his arms and sort of said, well, we know exactly who this son of a bitch is. But from that, a number of people began to defect. And my military advisor, who knew about these projects from family, and it was very highly placed in military circles, reached out and just sort of found me. And then a number of these witnesses did. Initially, we just had about a dozen of them. And then by the mid-90s, we had about 40. By 1995, when we organized the first gathering of Russian and American and other cosmonauts and astronauts and witnesses in Asilomar, which is near Monterey, California, that, you know, we had quite a few dozen. And it just kept growing. And so that by, you know, 2000, 2001, we had several hundred of these people. And then the question became, well, you know, who do we put forward first? And we're still telling people, step forward and be counted and speak up about what you know about this. If you're someone who has been in a government position, and you know, eventually people like John Callahan, who is the third highest ranking official at the FAA, who analyzed the Alaska Japan Airlines case over Alaska, you know, he I'm paraphrasing, but he says, you know, everyone wonders where are the high officials who have seen the data and have been involved in these things and who have been witness to the cover up of this. He says, I'm one of those high officials. So I decided, and I tell people, get on disclosureproject.org and you can see his testimony. It's there for anyone to see.
Oh, it was huge. I remember when I was just doing, Stephen, my local show in St. Louis.
Right.
My first exposure to you in terms of full knowledge was with Stephen Bassett at the time, was doing some lobbying. And he said, George, you're not going to believe this great story that Dr. Stephen Greer is working on. It's coming down pretty soon. And I would interview Dr. Mitchell and some people like that. And sure enough, I mean, you came out with these people a couple of years later. And I went, this has got to be one of the biggest stories of the world.
Right.
And then if I remember, didn't 9/11 tragically mix in with that in terms of the same time period?
Well, there are a couple of weird coincidences in this whole effort. One of the weird coincidences is that the very day that the story was going to break in a major New York newspaper that everyone would read, that's all I'm going to say, about the CIA director for President Bill Clinton looking into this matter and being stiff-armed and shut out, the very day that was going to break, because I was being interviewed personally by this New York paper, the Monica Lewinsky story broke.
Ah, okay.
And
that was one of them. That's
okay,
right.
And it was 24 hours a day. That's all it was.
Yep.
Then about the time, of course, in May of 2001, we had this National Press Club event. Again, you know, people can go to disclosureproject.org and for free can see that two-hour press conference with these military witnesses standing up in front of the world's cameras. And we have on our website a way that people can actually fax their member of Congress and senators asking for open hearings on this. Well, what I've never said publicly before is that every congressional office was getting thousands of fax letters demanding an open hearing. And this was reaching such a crescendo, I was getting calls from members of Congress saying, what in the hell is this? And just about the time that was really going, boom, 9/11 happened. Now, some people would say that that was a tragic coincidence, or perhaps deliberate. But whatever it was, of course, then it became something where that was all that the media could focus on was, of course, the terrible tragedy of 9/11, which is understandable. And so what I've seen over the years is that the national security superstate, which is not just U.S., it's transnational, is very, very good at moving people's attention away from this subject when they need to. What my biggest personal trial has been, frankly, is staying the course and keeping one foot in front of the other, moving forward.
Has it been frustrating for you, Stephen?
Oh, yeah, enormously. I mean, to the point of terrible despondency sometimes. And yeah, of course. I mean, I wouldn't be human if I didn't admit that this has been. Let me put it this way. The last day that I was in the ER, the very last hour of the last patient I had was a little 3 or 4 year old boy that had choked to death at a picnic that came in flatline that I worked an hour to try to save. And then this big, burly man collapsed in my arms, screaming and crying because his son died. The stuff I dealt with has been more difficult than that. So.
Oh, my. Well, and you're dealing now with two subject matters that are hands-off, that of course, UFOs and extraterrestrials, and then you went into trying, and you still are, these zero-point energy sources for us to reduce our dependency on oil. I mean, you are going right at the heart of something that could, honestly, Stephen, get you killed. And
well,
you need
course.
To be careful.
No, we know this. And you know, when CIA Director Bill Colby was going to transfer one of these operational energy devices to us and about $50 million in funding to try to get this out because he was getting very old and didn't want this secrecy to continue, the week that he was going to meet with a member of my board, they found him floating down the Potomac River. And his best friend, who's a full bird colonel, came to us and said he was assassinated because they did not want him to do this. So, yeah, there's been some terrible things that have happened. There's been wonderful things and beautiful cosmic things that have happened. But, you know, we're really in a battle here, I think, for the future of Earth and the future of humanity. And a lot of people don't realize that the secrecy that surrounds these extraordinary and wondrous energy generation, so-called anti-gravity and zero-point energy systems, the secrecy around that and the secrecy about the UFO matter are the same because it's the same group that wants to keep all this away from the public until they can bring it out in a way that further consolidates their power. And the way they want to do that is through engendering fear. What they don't want is for humanity to become unified and peaceful. They want us to become unified and at war. And this is why there's so much fear-mongering and scare tactics dealing with the extraterrestrial issue. One of the most astounding things I discovered back in the 1990s was a whole group of people who had been on a human abduction squad where they would go out and abduct people, including military officials and political figures such as Pérez de Cuellar at the UN, and make it look like, quote, aliens did it. And these guys were telling me, oh, yeah, we've been doing this for years because we want people to be afraid of them and to hate them. So, you know, it's a propaganda war, in my opinion, that so much of the information out there just scares the pants off of people. But if you're going to have an enemy, you have to have people afraid. And fear is one of the best ways for a relatively small number of people to control huge numbers of people. It's worked throughout history, and it's working today.
Oh, absolutely. There are some people out there that are taking their pot shots at you, Stephen. John Alexander said on one of our programs a few weeks ago that your Disclosure Project had some great witnesses and some people who were a little whacked out, and that's a paraphrase, and that he thought that hurt the effort. Paul Kimball in Canada said that he doesn't think Paul Hellyer is reliable at all because he got most of his information from the Day After Roswell book and doesn't think that you should have surrounded yourself with him. So there are some people out there that take their shots at you, and I wanted to get your reaction.
One of the things I say is that, look, we're not surrounding ourselves with anyone. I will meet with anyone who wants to know what's happening and share the information and the testimony and the documents and the perspective we have. And, hey, you know, it's a free world. My perspective on this is one thing. Whether someone agrees with it or not, that's fine. But we're doing the best we can to get the truth out that we know. And there's no deception here, and we have no ties, like some of the folks that you've just mentioned, to paramilitary and intelligence operations that have a long history of disinforming the public. So what I would say is that you just have to look at the track record and what the motivations are behind those interests. And, you know, when I met with Paul Hellyer, he sincerely wants to know about the subject. He sincerely wants to see the truth come out, and he sincerely wants to see our civilization move forward. I don't know all of his political and other views. We didn't have but one day together.
Mm-hmm.
But my view of it is that the man is sincere and wants the truth to be known, and he's a very good man. And I know when I met with Senator Claiborne Pell, he had the same sort of spirit about this. And one of the things that I remember saying to Senator Pell, who was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate at the time, I said, you know, Senator, you've been deprived of dealing with the ultimate foreign relations issue. And I pointed to the stars above our head because we were out on this patio in San Rafael, California. And he looked at me through these horn-rimmed black, you know, horn-rimmed glasses and blinked and said, "Well, Dr. Greer, I'm afraid you may be right." I said, "Well, I am." I said, "You know, we have good people on this planet that ought to be in the vanguard of an interplanetary effort and an effort to understand this issue, disclose it, bring the technologies out, have a positive future in space with these other civilizations that are surely out there." And instead, it's been hijacked by a kleptocracy of folks who have deceived our public officials and the general public alike.
Dr. Greer, the late Philip Corso, whom I believe had some incredible information,
yes,
documenting it in his book with Bill Burns, whom I know very well. He's a co-author with me in a book that will be out in September. So I believe Bill. And if Bill has, if not even knowing Corso, because I never met the man, Bill tells me that he believes Corso's story is true and right. that the notes that he saw were absolutely true. I believe.
I saw the notes also, by the way. Yeah. I was at Corso's home and saw them.
Yep. Apparently, you know, there might have been some more notes, and Corso's got more detail, and unfortunately he's left us, but his son might be an incredible ingredient here to getting some more information out. Any word on that?
Well, I know a few years ago when I was at his son's home, and he Corso and his son's home, and saw all these notes. I mean, there was a stack 2 or 3 feet high of amazing material that the colonel had. And, you know, I remember at the time encouraging his son to do what he can to get as much of that out to the public. And also, and this is really key, is to try to find points of corroboration. You know, one of the things that we've tried to do at the Disclosure Project, and, you know, people can criticize us, but you have to understand, we've never had any funding. This whole effort has been out of my back pocket,
right.
and another emergency physician, and a handful of people. And if people want to see more disclosure, I'd say, well, get on disclosureproject.org and make a donation. It's not as if this is some big multi-million-dollar effort going on here. But what we have said to people all along is that when you have a figure like Corso come along, try to get other people who can corroborate aspects mm-hmm. of it. And that's what we've done. If you look at our the book Disclosure that has the transcripts of the testimony of all these top secret witnesses, we have not one or two, but numerous people who were involved with Strategic Air Command, NORAD, and the nuclear missiles, where these ET craft were very concerned about what we were doing with nuclear weapons. We have multiple people who are military and civilian radar operators who saw and tracked these on radar, because many of the debunkers will get up and say, well, if these things were real, why aren't they tracked on radar? Well, they are. And here are the radar tapes, and here are the images, and here are the people who man the tower, and here are the people who are at the console. So what we've tried to do is not let something, you know, as Carl Sagan said, the one thing I agree with, he says, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that's what we've tried to put together to the best of our humble ability with our limited resources.
Stephen, when we come back, let's talk about that fear, why some people are out there claiming that these extraterrestrials are out to get us, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, is Hidden Truth on Amazon.com yet, or what can we do to help you get up on that list?
Yeah, people can call 888-ETCSETI to order it, or at disclosureproject.org. They can order it from there or at Amazon. And then it's beginning to get out into some other bookstores as well. But
good.
The best way is probably disclosureproject.org to get it the quickest.
Some people in...
By the way, did you get the one I sent you?
I sure do, and it's signed, and I'm going to cherish it for many, many years.
Oh, good. I'm glad it didn't get intercepted by someone and you actually got it.
Actually, I found it on someone's desk. I'm not going to say who. I took it back. I'm the rightful owner anyway.
Good.
There are some in your field who claim that extraterrestrials are out to hurt us, that they're evil. Some say, you know, dimensional, and they talk about devils, but let's not get into that right now.
Right.
But they do believe that there's an agenda here, and very interested with what you said just a moment ago, that fear controls people, and I'm wondering if they have steered people in the direction to let them think and believe that these extraterrestrials are out for evil purposes in order to continue that fear, or really if there is something going on. David Jacobs, for example, believes that these extraterrestrials are abducting people, conducting horrible experiments, and that they have an agenda.
Right. Well, I think there's a conflation of experiences people have with an interpretive spin that's decidedly xenophobic. I remember speaking with Monsignor Balducci at the Vatican a few years ago, and, you know, he was a theologian to the Pope, and he was actually a demonologist. And I brought this issue up with him. He says, absolutely, devils and angels don't need to fly in a flying saucer or in a spacecraft.
I
said, you're absolutely right. And we discussed this, and, and when I began to bring up this issue of, whether there's the good ETs and the bad ETs, and he looked at me and he said, and this is a hilarious quote that's actually in the disclosure book that has his testimony along with a lot of the military people, and he said, lower than humanity there cannot be in the entire universe. So he says, what are we talking about? Who pot call the kettle black? Seriously, I think that my perspective on this, having had contact with these ETs over a lot of my life and having led expeditions all over the world where we've had very close encounters and amazing things happen with these beings and with the craft at close range, my view of it is that most of the information that tends to scare people is either misinterpreted or it's deliberately hoaxed. Now, one of the things I found as I began to research this and got, and it's sort of like an onion. You keep pulling back layers and layers, and you think you're at the core of it, and you got 38 more layers to go.
Yeah.
And
you're crying along the way.
And you're crying along the way, and it stinks to high heaven. But the bottom line is that I have found that there are very well-organized counterintelligence operations that use things called ARVs, alien reproduction vehicles, and have creatures that look like aliens, but they're man-made, and that they have engaged in all manner of psychological warfare programs, which unless you had been read into those programs, unless you had met with people, and I have met with multiple independent corroborating people who have seen these disinformation projects at work, you could be forgiven for thinking that it was actually an extraterrestrial encounter. And I think that this has been done deliberately, and I liken it to, if you have a gold nugget and you really want to hide it, well, the best way is to dump a whole ton of fool's gold on top of it. And unfortunately, I don't think that we've done a very good job of doing an assay to figure out what's the fool's gold and what's the real thing. And when you realize that there is an enormous multi-trillion-dollar interest group that wants to keep the public deceived on this, never mind the $1 trillion a year military-industrial laboratory complex, you begin to realize that it would be very easy to infiltrate and subvert the civilian UFO community and the media on this issue so that there would be an ongoing stream of disinformation, but not just disinformation that's just false on the face, but which has a decidedly negative spin so that eventually, as Wernher von Braun told one of our witnesses, they could justify a war in space and the militarization and weaponization of space and the targeting of other planetary systems. And I think that this is one of the real risks of the current era, is that as Eisenhower said to one of our witnesses, this whole matter was not going to be in the best of hands, and he knew it. And I've had a number of people at the level of presidential intelligence tell me that they knew that this issue was going to slip out of the control of the constitutional authorities into this transnational superstate that's very shadowy, and that their agendas do not necessarily coincide with the best interests of either the United States or of humanity. And I think that it's very easy then to hoax events, to disinform the public, mm-hmm. and to frighten people. And I think that a lot of people, what I say to people is that you really can't judge whether it's extraterrestrial or human until you've penetrated the covert world of human projects and seen what our capabilities consist of. When I interviewed a man who in 1953 had witnessed the teleportation and dematerialization of a solid object from one point of an Air Force base to another point on an Air Force base, and this was before I was a twinkle in my father's eye, that the technologies that we have that are within classified projects can hoax a great deal. And because that has not been studied adequately, and because it has not been disclosed adequately, our leaders in Washington and elsewhere, as well as the public, are very vulnerable to deception. Now, my military advisor, when we went to the Pentagon to brief the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency a couple years ago, said that one of the chief things we had to do was give a heads up to him and to, before we met with him, the head of intelligence for the Joint Staff, about what he called a deceptive indication and warning, or a false INW. And what that is when a deeply covert program rolls out a hoaxed event that then manipulates the military, mm-hmm. intelligence community, the political leadership, the media, and the public into a given direction.
And these things have happened. Example. Sure. They've happened before.
Oh, it's happening all the time.
Yeah.
And this is the mother of all deceptions. I call it the cosmic Gulf of Tonkin scenario. And one of the men who had been on one of the planning sessions back in the 70s, this is about 1974, who was at the briefings that we did for members of Congress in 97, he turned to me and he says, you know, I sat in on meetings that were interagency and corporate meetings, very, very covert, where we discussed the use of these Lockheed Martin and Northrop alien reproduction vehicles and these creatures that look like grays that are actually what are called PLFs, program life forms, to stage an attack on the Earth so that we could then convince people that they needed to spend trillions more in weaponizing space. And he says, we've had this rate of rollout since the 60s. My mouth dropped open then. I didn't realize that the guy could possibly be telling the truth. But I have since met with multiple independent corroborating witnesses who confirmed this, that we have had, at least since the 60s, maybe before, the capacity to simulate extraterrestrial events. And this is the part where people don't want to look. They do not want to look into this black box because that's what's really frightening. The extraterrestrial civilizations, look, I remember going from Lawrence Rockefeller's ranch, I tell this story in Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, to the division that had the original Roswell material sent to them. And my military advisor and a couple other spooks were with me. And I went to this meeting, and the colonel I was meeting with turned to me and he said, well, what if these extraterrestrial civilizations are hostile? And I said, sir, given what we have been doing and the stupidity with which we've been doing it for the last 50 years, if they were, we would not be having this conversation and breathing the free air of Earth.
That's so true.
You know, I said it would have been point, set, match about 1952, end of discussion. So I think that there's been a lot of patience and forbearance shown by these extraterrestrials, given the fact that our civilization has been spinning out of control for over 50 years with hydrogen bombs, nuclear weapons, early space exploration. And I have to tell you, the configuration of electromagnetic weapon systems, some of which are extremely advanced and are crossed into what some would call interdimensional systems, that have been targeting and occasionally hitting and downing extraterrestrial vehicles.
Well, these NASA videos that we've seen, what, STS 48 and 80, I think.
Yes, that's a testing of that.
Incredible.
Well, and this is, of course, you know what, and this is why, by the way, I don't know if you've been following this brouhaha in Great Britain with this hapless character named...
Gary McKinnon?
I've
got him on this coming Tuesday.
Well, you know, the thing is, George, he did what he did after he heard about the Disclosure Project. I feel so terrible. But to be honest with you, I'm getting ready to write an amicus brief in defense of this guy, not for him hacking, but listen carefully to what I'm going to say.
Right.
If, let's say I'm running an illegal operation, and I enter into a contract with George Nouri, you are not bound by that contract under constitutional law because the operation that you were contracting with is illegal. A priori, there's no binding legal authority to that contract. In the same way, the databases, the witnesses, the documents pertaining to this subject, as far as I'm concerned, And as far as the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff is concerned, because he told me this personally at his office at the Pentagon, these projects are being run by a rogue element that are extra-constitutional, transnational, illegal. I know for a fact they have lied to the U.S. president. I know for a fact that the CIA director I briefed was lied to. I know for a fact that a Secretary of Defense that we worked with was lied to, et cetera. A priori, they cannot claim the rule of law to protect themselves. And in my opinion, they don't have a leg to stand on in prosecuting Gary McKinnon for the acquisition of the information. Now, what he did to the computers and hacking, I can't comment
on.
But I'm talking about the information itself. And by the way, this was the constitutional legal argument we used when we came forward with all these top secret military witnesses. We said, look, doesn't matter if they signed a legal agreement or a security oath or had a top secret clearance or a Umbra or past Q-38 levels, which, by the way, the stuff we're dealing with is about 38 levels past Q clearance, which is nuclear launch code level. And, you know, I said that these people cannot be held to the secrecy since the group that is running these projects is a criminal enterprise. It's the largest RICO, or racketeering influence corrupt organization, on the planet. Therefore, they can't turn around and use the courts and the law to enforce the secrecy.
Right.
And this is when I said this to an admiral who is the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he looked at me and said, you are absolutely right. And let me tell you a little story. It's in this book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. I gave this man a document that I got through contacts. It was a secret document. And it had the code numbers and code names of some of the projects as of the 90s that were dealing with the ET issue out of the Nellis facility. And he looked into it and found that, one of those compartmented operations was in the Pentagon. And he called them up. This is the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I love this.
I'm at this meeting. And this man calls them up and he says, I'm Admiral so-and-so. I want to be read into, which is the lingo they use, I want to be read into this project. And they say to him, sir, we cannot read you into this project, and you do not have a need to know. And he said, damn it, if I don't have a need to know, who does? I'm the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they said, sir, we will not read you into this project. Click, and they killed the line.
Oh, my.
Now, this is a true story. By the time I got to this meeting with this admiral, he was, you know, four-plus hopping mad. And not at me, but when I described to him the big picture of what was going on with this and what the technologies were and what was being stolen from humanity and that we were destroying our biosphere and impoverishing 80% of the world's population and killing our young men in the Middle East because we're trying to protect our national security interests because of oil, for crying out loud, which we don't need, he looked at me and he said, Dr. Greer, you can take all these witnesses and all these documents, I don't care if they're declassified or not, and take them to the media and let anyone who will listen hear the truth. And he said that to me, and I have witnesses to him saying that. So when people say, gee, how did you end up actually, you know, opening the door to all this stuff a few years ago with the Disclosure Project, I said, well, I was encouraged to do so by none less than the head of intelligence for the Joint Staff.
Well, and it worked. And I'm convinced that as they move toward this one world government, and that's what they want to do, we both know that, that once they probably take advantage of every other country and wars really start to diminish, they still need to build their hardware, generate their revenue. That's when they pull out the old extraterrestrials are going to attack us. Out of
sure.
The old hat.
Absolutely. That's what they're waiting to do, and they're going to play that card unless we wake up and let people know what the truth is first. And I just tell people, don't be deceived. Don't be stampeded like a bunch of cows into this corral of fear. Look to a good future, and I think that if we join together, we can create a good future together. But it's going to take a lot of hard work, and we're going to have to wake up.
Stephen, take a few moments before the top of the hour, and then we'll take calls next hour with regards to your quest for Zero Point, getting any closer to finding any of these devices.
Yes, sir. We do have located one, and we're working with this inventor who is, of course, very skittish. And I hope that we will be able to move that system along over the next few months. I have a team that will be working on reproducing it here fairly soon, and so
you're still bullish and excited about this.
Oh, you have to keep moving on it, no matter what the odds are, because there's too much at stake. I mean, it's the life of the planet is at stake, and you don't walk away from this. This is not like returning a string of pearls to Tiffany's. This is something you don't look back on and turn your back on. You've got to do what you can do.
What made you jump ahead to zero point rather than work in stages of trying to get hydrogen fuel or something like that first?
Well, because we know that the current systems for getting hydrogen actually are more polluting than a hybrid Prius in terms of the total net effect on the environment, number one. And number two, the day that 9/11 happened, my first call was to my wife. My second call was to get my daughter out of D.C. because she's an architect there. My third call was to my military advisor, and I said, this is the signal we were looking for, because we knew from multiple sources, including Wernher von Braun, that after the Cold War, they would roll out global terrorism, and that was the penultimate stage right before they tried to hoax a threat from outer space to seize global domination around a military junta that would force the world into this fear and reaction to fear. And I said, we have got to start moving forward with the fundamental building blocks of a new civilization on this planet, which includes not only the information about the technologies, but the actual technological devices themselves. And so that's why we're trying to move that forward.
It's a big fight, though, isn't it, Stephen? It's constant battle to try to get stuff like this accomplished.
Yeah, of course. And you know, it's not as if there aren't enormously powerful vested interests that want to hijack the effort and disrupt it. But that doesn't deter us at all. And, you know, one of the things I learned from this wonderful, even though at the time I was very sick, near-death experience, is that I'm sort of view myself as living now about 33 years past my expiration date.
And every day's great, then.
Yeah, and so my view of it is that, you know, all of us, no one survives this life. Everyone eventually falls under this canopy of dust and moves on to another plane. But what I think is important is what you try to do while you're here. And so my view of it is that I'm not concerned about those negative issues. I want to stay focused on the good future we can create.
All right, stay with us. So we'll give you an opportunity next to talk with Dr. Stephen Greer. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, not that I'm greedy or anything, but you mentioned that you might be dropping another bombshell or two. Any more things there?
Well, one of the things I wanted to share with people is that I feel that people have to understand that the conscious mind that is within each of us is the same conscious mind that's within an extraterrestrial life form or any other sentient, higher intelligent life form. And, you know, Erwin Schrödinger, who is the father of particle wave theory and became quantum mechanics, said the total number of minds in the universe is one. That is, it's a singularity. And one of the things I've tried to do in this whole project is to put this in, take the long view of the nature of intelligent life in the universe. And one of the things that we've created, by the way, with this book is a meditation CD that people can get at disclosureproject.org, or they can call 888-ET-CSETI. And I meant to send that to you, and I'll send you one.
Okay.
But it basically is a meditation CD that takes people into this ability, this state of consciousness, where they enter into cosmic awareness and begin to experience the non-local, infinite aspect of the mind that's within us. And this to me is the fundamental truth that these extraterrestrial visitors are not only sharing with us, or wanting us to awaken to, that it's not as most people think it's some sort of a linear message. Like they try to interpret the crop circles, or it's a language of something. I think it's something more archetypical, more profound, and that has to do with awakening within ourselves this universal resonant field of conscious mind. And I think this is really what the big meta theme of the next thousand or few thousand years of human history is going to involve.
All right, let's go to the calls as promised. We'll pick it up, first of all, by going west of the Rockies. You're on the air with Dr. Stephen Greer. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jim in Grand Junction, Colorado.
Sure, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Glad to talk to you guys, Dr. Greer. I have a question here,
sure.
And maybe two questions, and then I'll ask you, and then I'll get off and listen on the air. If you guys, you know, have contact with these aliens and you've been working with them, is it possible that you could get them to single out these bad guys and beam them up or get rid of them or something?
You know? It's a very tempting idea. No, it's actually a good question. You know, I think that one of the things I caution against is, and people think I'm joking when I use this term, is cosmic codependency, where we sort of view these visitors from other civilizations as somehow either our nemesis or our saviors. And I think they're neither. And I think that the responsibility for fixing the mess we've created rests squarely on the shoulders of us humans. Now, it doesn't mean that they're not there to understand and perhaps to assist behind the scenes some, or perhaps to make preparations for a time when humans quit acting like a bunch of squabbling, madmen, and begin to live in a civilized fashion. But I don't believe that they're going to, take care of these fundamental problems themselves. I think that if we are ever going to evolve as a civilization, these are hard lessons we have to learn ourselves. And I liken it to the experience of growing up, that humanity is at the late adolescent phase of our development. And if we're going to enter into the maturity of adulthood, the hallmark of which is a peaceful civilization on this planet that's open and free, I think that we have to achieve that primarily on our own. I'm not saying that there's no points of assistance. I think there's assistance from various realms and dimensions and aspects. But ultimately, it has to come through us. Otherwise, we don't really own it. We haven't mastered it.
Okay.
And it'll be a temporary fix.
Okay. And also, I live in the desert here in Grand Junction. And can you tell me where this meeting is going to be that you talked about earlier and how I could come along and watch? Or
yeah, this is a week-long intensive training. It involves, I train people in the experience of consciousness and the remote viewing techniques that I learned when I was quite young, not the military ones, but the ones that are more based in the experience of expanded consciousness. And then we go out that's during the daytime, and then at night, we go out under the stars till 1 or 2 or 3 in the morning, using these techniques and also using electronic signals and lasers and other modalities. And this is going to be held in Southern Colorado on the the west side of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains in the first week of July. And you can find out about that at disclosureproject.org or CSETI.org and register for it there. We're also going to be doing it on Mount Shasta over the Labor Day week, and also in late September here in Charlottesville out at our farm in Virginia. And we'll also be in the high desert of California and Joshua Tree Wilderness in Palm Springs in November. So we do this 3 or 4 times a year to give people the experience not only of the universal state of consciousness that I think is the ultimate communicator, but also to train people in what it is like to be out in the field with a group of people when one of these objects shows up, or where mysteriously, and this gets into the high strangeness stuff that J. Allen Hynek used to talk about, where suddenly in the group there will be almost what looks like a scintillating holographic figure of an ET that will appear in the middle of the group. And this has happened multiple times where people have literally been touched, where the electronic tones that we're sending out into space over radio signals come back through the group in sort of an omnidirectional way. It's really extraordinary, the things that have happened on these expeditions. And, the technologies these ETs are using are not your granddad's Oldsmobile. And it's some pretty extraordinary things. And I can say that having done that for 16 years all over the world, we have never had a frightening or negative experience, which is why I'm rather skeptical of all the tales of, vivisection and attack and all this horrible stuff. Because we've gone to areas where these things are reported, and the experiences we have, the only things that we've ever happened that have been terrifying have been at the hands of fellow humans. And so, you know, for example, we were shaken down and robbed several nights in a row in Mexico when we were out there one year. And so, but in terms of the extraterrestrial people, we've never had anything happen that is even remotely frightening.
Let's go to our wild card line now. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi there. George here.
Hi, George.
I'm Dr. Gere. I'm 70 years old now. I hope you're younger than I am.
Yeah.
And the thing is that back in President Reagan's year, I had a physicist, and we built what is called an over-unity machine.
Right.
And the big thing about the over-unity machine is after we got the thing powered up, is you got to power it down.
Right.
I wanted to tell you that you have to have some kind of a sink to discharge all that power.
Correct.
But I can say a 48-inch disc counter-rotating will lift 700 pounds, and in a certain sense, until the parts wear out, will sustain it.
Right.
It'd work. So what I'm saying, if you have a physicist that knows his electronics and knows how to counter-rotate, put the proper electrodes together and using... It can be either micro or micro or macro. It will work. It'll lift off, sustain itself, and you're dealing with dimensional poles, just like on a battery.
Right.
That's the key to it. Without, and it's not that hard. That's the thing. And you're saying it's suppressed. It's amazing to me. We petitioned the government back in that time to have it made. The scientist says, well, it sounds good, but it can't be done. But we flew it. So I just want to encourage you, continue. That also not only will fly, but it is a generator. And when it's properly generated, you have for the source around this planet all the energy. And as you say, oil is needed to grease bearings.
Correct. Well, I would invite you to contact me so we could discuss this in more detail. And I'd be interested in your information and perspective on this and see how we could compare notes on it.
Stephen, what's the best website to get to you?
DisclosureProject.org, and this gentleman can contact me, and my webmaster will send that message on to me.
Great. Next up, let's go to our, let's see whose turn. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello? Going once. Oh, well.
By the way, as a sort of a parenthetical note, this man that called in, what he's describing, I know to be true, and there are many people who have worked on these sort of technologies. We have had people who have actually seen the old late 50s, early 60s prototypes of the so-called alien reproduction vehicles, which were, quote, flying saucers that were electromagnetic anti-gravity systems. These were being test flown in the early 60s. In fact, we have a photograph of one being test flown over Provo, Utah, in 1964. And Ben Rich, who was the head of Lockheed Skunk Works, told three members of the Disclosure Project that we already had the means to travel among the stars faster than the speed of light. And he said that prior to his death. And but he also said it's a shame that it hasn't come out to benefit humanity. It would take an act of God to finally get this out to benefit the world. And what I say to people is that, well, that may be true, but perhaps God works through us, and if we, you know, keep moving forward, we can get this out, and eventually it'll happen. It's not a matter of if; it's a matter of when. How much damage and suffering to humanity and the Earth and the biosphere has to happen before we quit lying to each other about the fact that the fabric of space and time all around us is filled with so much energy that some people have estimated that every cubic centimeter of space in the room that you're sitting in has enough energy to run the Earth for a day. And it's absurd for us to be fighting, you know, oil war number 10 or destroying the biosphere when, as this gentleman said, oil is only needed to lubricate the bearings and for plastics and synthetics. It is not needed as an energy source.
So true. Next up, first-time caller line, you're on with Dr. Stephen Greer. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Linda in Folsom, California, and I just wanted to say that I have been with Dr. Stephen Greer for about the past 10 years. I've been one of his assistants. I've been on over two dozen of his expeditions all over the United States, several times in England. I have never experienced anything the least bit scary. I have only experienced amazement and delight. They have been among the most wonderful experiences of my life. He's been one of the most wonderful teachers of my life. I've got to say that any of his detractors have not spent time with him, have not heard him speak from his heart, do not realize that his total intention is for universal peace and peace on this planet and to save this planet. And I can't say anything more wonderful about the projects and to invite people, if they want to experience some of the most wonderful things in their life, to come along on some of the CSA expeditions coming up this year.
Yeah, thanks, Linda. Good hearing your voice again.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate that call. Very nice of her. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Richard calling from Visalia. My uncle was in the OSS, the Overseas Service,
right?
Back in 41, 42, 43, during the European War.
Right.
And he was flying north out of England. He said he left in the morning because they were looking for patrols or something. And when he got up and he was away from England and stuff, and they were up a couple of miles and on this flying fortress or whatever they were flying, they were up there about 2 or 3 miles, and the pilot and were looking out the window over to the right, and he's a navigator, and he was sitting there doing his stuff and listening to the radio and stuff, and they're kind of having a commotion up there. And he went over there and looked, and he looked off to the right or wherever it was, and they saw this orb out there moving alongside of him. And he said it was about a half a mile, a quarter mile away, and it was moving back and forth and was looking at him. And he goes, "What the heck is that?" And somebody was saying, "I don't know, does he have an insignia?" And they couldn't see it, you know, because it was kind of like floating back and forth. And all of a sudden he says, it was gone. It just like it was there. And he says, it took off and it made like a 2-degree turn to the left. And he says, it was gone. And he says, if that would have been a Nazi or plane or a German plane or something like that, we didn't have a hope.
Oh no, I absolutely. And in fact, a dear friend of mine who's a fellow physician, a medical doctor in Denver, was the nephew of Jimmy Doolittle. And Jimmy Doolittle was actually sent over to the World War II theater in Europe to investigate these things called Foo Fighters. Yes, that's a rock band group, but they took their name from these things that, this gentleman just described. And he came back and reported directly back to President Roosevelt that they were interplanetary vehicles. And I have this from Jimmy Doolittle's nephew, who is a fellow physician, very credible man. And yes, these were reported. The other thing I should point out is that we have a witness that's in the Disclosure Project materials, and his transcript is in the book Disclosure that has about 600 pages of these top secret military witness testimony. And he was at an Air Force facility in Canada just after World War II, and he saw a gun camera footage and photographs of these so-called orbs and craft that were seen during the World War II operations in the 40s. And we have many, many reports of these, in fact.
Would you have loved to have been, because I would have, outside the White House in 52 with that UFO flap?
Yes, well, actually, I've interviewed people who were there, including people at the radar tower and some of the pilots who were present when that occurred. And, in fact, I don't think it's a coincidence that happened almost concurrently with our detonating the ultimate doomsday weapon, the hydrogen bomb on Bikini Atoll in the summer of 1952. And if you talk to many of the men who have been at the strategic air facilities, and their testimony, again, is in at disclosureproject.org, they state that there is no question that these ET vehicles were very concerned about our nuclear weapons capabilities. And I asked one of them, a captain who was in the Air Force, I said, what was the message? What were they doing? He says, I think they were trying to warn us not to blow up this beautiful planet. And this is a guy who had a Q clearance and was in, you know, had his finger on the button to launch intercontinental ballistic missiles back in the 60s when many of these ET craft were seen overflying the flight lines and launch control facilities out in Minot, North Dakota, and similar facilities in the United States. By the way, I have to point out that the same things were happening in the Soviet Union. And so it's not as if they were picking on the good old U.S. of A. I think they were looking at the capabilities all over the world. And Colonel Dietrichson, who is one of our witnesses, who was with the Atomic Energy Commission after he left the Air Force, stated very directly that every single nuclear weapons storage facility and manufacturing facility had had these UFOs over them and around them all through the 50s and 60s and while he was involved. And his testimony is extremely interesting and very, very compelling.
Stephen, it has been an absolute delight so far to talk with you tonight. We'll come back and take final phone calls, okay?
Thank you.
Our guest, Dr. Stephen Greer, final calls on Coast to Coast AM just ahead. On our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, before we get into those special Friday night into Saturday morning open lines, our guest will be none other than television, late night television guru, Susan Powder. So get ready for that. She's different. We'll have her on the program. But when we come back, the rest of your calls with Dr. Stephen Greer on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, you think they're still trying to keep you quiet from trying to get the word out about the disclosure project?
Well, sure. I mean, one of the things that I reveal in this new book, Hidden Truth, The Forbidden Knowledge, are the inside meetings I've had with big media people. For example, we had a series of meetings with the executive producer of ABC News, who, before they did that terrible documentary last year, that wanted to have all these top-secret people and evidence put forward in a series of Primetime Live and 2020 exposés. And this man, I gave him literally 35 digital hours out of the 110 hours we had filmed of all these top-secret military and corporate intelligence witnesses, a lot of which has never been put out to the public because we just, you know, it's more material than the public can digest. He said this was the most astounding body of information he'd ever seen, and he wanted to do at least one, if not several, hour-long Primetime Live and 2020 programs on it. A couple weeks later, he calls me back and he says, "Well, Dr. Greer, they're not going to let me do this." And I said, "Well, what do you mean, they? Who are they?" And he said, "Dr. Greer, you know who they are. And they killed the project." And this is a man who was the executive director of ABC News who allegedly had complete control over that. We've seen the same thing happen in Hollywood a number of years ago. One of the biggest, the second biggest grossing producer in Hollywood, Arnold Copelson, wanted to do a full-length feature film about all of this, but the true story, basically the story of my life. And I told someone, you know, this new book would be a great little script for a movie.
Sure.
Because it's all true. But he wanted to do it way back, and this is back in the late 90s when we were doing the congressional briefings. And, you know, we went out there and I met with him, and he had writers from the X-Files there. And he says, you know, I have a $60 million budget for this, and I have complete control over it. A couple weeks later, he calls me back, and his assistant calls me back and says, "Well, you know, they're not going to let him do this." And I said, "Well, why not? I thought he had complete control over the studio." They said, "Oh, no, not over this." So, you know, I'm just giving you a few little anecdotes. But, you know, people who think that we actually have a free press when it comes to the big mainstream media, CNN, Time, Newsweek, are very, very naive. If you go to disclosureproject.org, I have an article up there about the media, and a man sent to me a top-secret document that had been declassified and I understand might have been reclassified, but on page 6 of that document, I'm paraphrasing, but basically what it says is that this is a CIA document from 1991, not that long ago, and it says, "We have cultivated contacts at all the world's media, wire services, news magazines, etc., to change, alter, stop, kill stories as needed." And this is done routinely, and American public thinks that, you know, the Fourth Estate is this big check and balance on this kind of runaway transnational secret effort, and it isn't. It's part of the problem. And I think that one of the things we're going to have to eventually do, I've said for years, I would love to start the Disclosure Network or Disclosure Network News, call it what you will, and basically on radio and satellite television just have a constant stream of these insiders telling the truth to the world's public. We need to do something like that, and I think it needs to happen sooner rather than later.
Let's go back to the calls. We'll go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, George. This is Blair in Sedona, Arizona.
Hey, Blair. Welcome.
Thank you, sir. Boy, Dr. Greer, this is quite a coincidence because August 8, 2004, when you were on with Art from Mount Shasta, I believe, ABC was in his Pahrump Studios filming, and none of you got on.
Well, it was interesting. I met with the, you know, I was involved with that project before the public really knew about it and was meeting with the producer and the executive producer of that show, that special. And when they found out what we were sitting on, they said, well, this is exactly what we want. We want to make history. And I said, well, I'll give you everything we put together. You know, I've put some $10 or $12 million of my career earnings and time and whatever doing this work for free. And I said, I'll just give it to you guys. I want the truth to get out there. He says, oh, this is what we're looking for. And when it came down to actually doing the show, they had cut, I mean, John Callahan with the FAA, they interviewed a lot of these guys. They cut every single one of them out of that two-hour special. It was a total cover-up. But, they, of course, they made it sound like, hey, we're really going to do some serious bit of ABC News expose on this. So, you know, these guys are actually shills for this shadow government. They're not part of the real truth about what's going on. And I think, unfortunately, the American public have quietly allowed to erode our basic freedoms, including the freedom and independence of a free press.
Well, don't you think the better way to go is to stay on the high road? In other words, dealing with this, what you term transnational security super state in regards to disclosure, don't you think maybe forgiveness and non-judgment would be the better way to go because of the fear that they themselves both foment and are victims of?
Oh, sure. I agree. And this is why I continue to have meetings with those people and say, look, you know, let the past be the past, but let's start a new beginning. And, in fact, one of the things I'll say here that's a bit of a bombshell, when I was preparing to meet with Clinton's first CIA director, I was told by two independent people on the inside of what some people would call MJ-12 or this secret group, that about a third of them really wanted this information out. I've been told that recently that number is hitting up around 50%. So out of the 200 or 300 people on this ruling policy group, that is international, it deals with this, almost half of them want this done. So I view this as an education process, and you know, to quote Bush's father, it's a vision thing. You know, we have to share with them a positive vision of how to get them out of this black box they've nailed shut around themselves, as I say. And I think that it's not about judging them per se, but it's about speaking the truth of what the stakes are. The stakes are very high, and this kind of misconduct and extreme misconduct that's gone along over the years with this, up to and including assassinations and intimidation and what have you, needs to stop. But in addition to it, they need to facilitate the release of this information in a way that would be positive, and that won't just redound to the further acquisition of centralized power in the world, but would actually be, you know, something that would lift humanity up to the next level.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Wow, this has been a fast night, Stephen. I mean, we got to get you back more often, huh?
Yeah, it'd be great to. I'd love to do that with you.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Doc, do you know anything about other dimensional beings that are conducting genetic experiments with willing participants here on Earth to create a hybrid human body that can act as a bridge between our worlds and that they can use to come in and interact in our world in?
Well, this has been reported widely. The genetic experiments I have seen that cross into the area you're discussing are actually very highly classified human projects. And one of the things I point out to people is that the advances that everyone talks about with things like zero-point energy and electrogravitic or anti-gravity systems, there's been a parallel development in the biological sciences, up to and including genetic and genetic cloning and experimentation. I don't know that there are any so-called hybridization programs, although some people have reported it. I do believe that the extraterrestrial civilizations that are out there have been studying the damage that we're doing to the global genome. And by genome, I mean the entire collective genetic material on this planet, through both radiation and pollution and the degradation of the environment. I do believe that there has been a program to monitor that, and I think there's some concern about that. And, you know, of course, then we could talk for probably an hour or two about that project. But there's a lot of evidence that suggests that this is something that they've studied and are concerned about.
Well, I can tell you secondhand, that is from a friend of mine, that there definitely does exist experiments that are being done. It seems that the participants who agreed before incarnating into the Earth, and maybe they wouldn't have agreed once they got here and saw what it was like. But there's a doctor in New Mexico that helped her, but who found scar tissue from operations done on the uterus, which is much cleaner than any surgeon could do now, and multiple times to create a being that, expressed a physiology which was more conducive to their entering into it.
Yeah, I would just say you have to be very careful about your conclusions. The data is one thing, the conclusions are another. And when people say, for example, with cattle mutilations, it's more precise, or this sort of thing that happened to this lady you're talking about, than any surgeon could do. I would say any non-classified surgeon can do. And one of the things I point out to people is that the technologies that reside within classified human projects will curl your hair if it's not curled already. And the capabilities are truly awesome. And so I think it's important to collect these cases and data. I think we have to be very careful about the kind of conclusions we reach, because I think there's an enormous amount of information that is not known by the public that is within the sphere of human ultra-secret classified projects and associated technologies.
The last question, when you talk about other terrestrial beings monitoring the Earth genome as a whole and taking an interest in it, does there seem to be any consensus on their side in terms of, there's no doubt there's a train heading for a crash in terms of depletion of non-renewable resource and pollution with toxic material? And
sure. I think there's no question that there's been a concern and a monitoring probably since the 1800s of the last 100 or 130 years of human history. And I suspect it's been going on for thousands of years, but there's certainly a great concern. And, you know, I was talking to a British intelligence official back a few years ago, and he said it's not an accident that there's really huge upsurge of sightings and encounters and things that happen corresponded with our beginning to detonate hundreds of nuclear weapons and experiments, putting enormous amounts of radiation into the atmosphere, degrading the environment with global warming, all sorts of, you know, there are 50,000 chemicals that are in this toxic stew that's mixed up in the air and the land and the water. And I think that these civilizations, which in fact may have been observing our development and evolution for a very long time, would be, it'd be absurd to think that they would observe all of this and not have concern. And I would add another layer to that. We're always, you know, from a human perspective, we're so self-centered. And I always say, step out of ourselves for a minute and step in the shoes of ET. And if you see a civilization like Earth going from horse and buggies to space exploration and muskets and rifles to nuclear weapons and even more fearsome weapons that are in classified projects, all within the span of one person's life, time, you know, 80, 90 years or what have you, you would have to be galactically brain dead not to be concerned about the trajectory we're on. And as this wonderful Chinese saying, you know, unless we change directions, we're likely to end up where we're going. And I think they are watching where we're going. I think there is concern. And I think that to some extent, there's concern that, you know, if we don't make a course correction, we're going to, you know, crash the system, and it's going to have to be rebooted to use a high-tech term. But certainly they're observing this, and I think they stand ready to get involved if it gets to a worst-case scenario. But I think it's going to have to get to a worst-case scenario before you're going to see a large-scale extraterrestrial intervention.
West of the Rockies, your turn. You're on with Stephen Greer. Hi there.
Good evening, George.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Hello, Dr. Greer.
Hello.
Gary here. I'm in Mesa, Arizona, currently. I believe we've met before, also with you, George, and Dr. Greer. I run a research group called TAP-10 Research.
Right.
I believe Richard Hoagland's mentioned us here.
Yes.
Anyway, going back to this Wernher von Braun's testimony, talking about they're going to create a war in space, and based on what you've mentioned tonight on the air, I have this heard mention of this by many sources, including a former guest on this program, that it appears as we're running on someone else's clock. And with saying that, I have this uncanny impression that perhaps this rogue agencies that you mentioned, Dr. Greer, shadow group of global multinationalists, whatever you want to call them,
right,
they're trying their best to ensure that they, the ones that you've asked about they, and you know who they are,
right,
that they want to ensure that they man the controlling mechanisms of this clock. But in order to expedite the process, you know, the process, it would be, you know, probably in their best assessment to assume that some form of global culling would have to take place for this coup de grace to seize power and reign over us.
Yeah, I think there are a number of agendas like that. And I think one of the things to be really clear about is that when you start talking about this particular group and their interests, it's not a monolith. There's a lot of controversy within that group. There's a lot of dissent. There are people who agree with the path they're on. There are people who don't. I have personally met with members of this group, and I can tell you that it's not by any means a sort of lockstep agreement with everything that's happening. And I will go so far as to say that within this group, there are rogue elements that have intimidated other members of the group. For example, I mentioned earlier that former CIA Director Bill Colby, he was defecting basically from this group when he was going to hand over to us some of these technologies and the means to get them out. And he was, you know, getting up there in years, and he knew he wasn't going to be alive that much longer, and he did not agree with the path that this group was taking the world on. And I think that it's important to understand that many of the people find themselves trapped in that system. And I think that one of the things we have to do compassionately is to provide a way out and provide a path out of that sort of mess that's been created. And I think that in many – I had a CIA guy come back in the 90s and flew into where I was living in North Carolina at the time. And he said, you know, hurry up and get this done. And I was, so my mouth dropped. I said, what do you mean hurry up? He says, we want this out. This needs to get done. And I said, well, then do it. He says, oh, no, we can't. It's too dangerous and there are too many other interests. So, you know, these people are not at all of one mind. And I think that we have to understand that if the people take some initiative and leadership, that more can happen than we can imagine, and that more is within our hands and within our control and within the vision that we see than perhaps we want to admit. I think many people are afraid of the fact that we have to be responsible for this planet and not just look to some boogeyman out there that we passively go tut-tut, we can't do anything about it. On the contrary, I think we have to do something about it, and we are ultimately responsible.
It's the story of Stephen Greer, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. Stephen, thanks for being on Coast to Coast.
Thank you. Great speaking with you again.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Rob Ismail, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, and the cast of 10 million others. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.